Hello, everybody. Yes, everybody.
Even me?
Yes. And welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the movie review podcast where we review a bunch of movies.
That's what we do. That's a film review podcast for you.
Kaboom.
Introduce yourself, will you?
My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a film critic. And welcome back.
Yeah,
we had to take a week off for timing reasons.
We had to take a week off. Whitney, as we mentioned in our most recent episode of We've Got Mail, Whitney is in a bit of a transitional phase in his day job and is doing a lot of extra hours. And so we had to make a lot fewer episodes last week than we normally do. But we're back on the old wagon. And, back on the old...
But in fact, starting in just a few days, I'll be starting my new job, so everything is just totally topsy-turvy.
Yeah, but hopefully in the very near future, our schedules will equalize, and this will actually be better for all of us, because not only will we be able to record more consistently, we will also be able to record before midnight.
That'll be nice, right?
So we won't be dropping dead on mic all the time. We usually edit that out. Anyway... This is Critically Acclaimed. This is our movie review podcast, and we got some catching up to do. So this week on Critically Acclaimed, we're going to be reviewing the new releases, and in some cases, new-ish releases. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, or rather just Texas Chainsaw Massacre, because that's the only difference. No Exit, Dog, Studio 666, The Cursed. The Cursed or The Cursed?
The Cursed.
The Cursed.
You know what? They're both correct.
Family Squares, A Banquet, and Hellbender. We are not reviewing the new release Uncharted. It is not by any particular design. It's because the only time they had like a press screening for that was on Valentine's Day.
At like 5 p.m. too.
Yeah, like we have plans. Like you can't just do this at the last minute. Like those of us who have significant others find our others to be significant. So we're not going to cancel our plans to go see Uncharted on Valentine's Day. And we just haven't had a chance to go because Whitney's been busy and so have I. There's no slight, we'll see it eventually and we'll give our thoughts if they're noteworthy, but we just haven't got around to it yet.
I haven't seen it. Here's my review. It's okay. All right, moving on.
That does seem to be the consensus. Anyway, so that's basically that. You're all caught up. We can move on. Let's review some movies, and let's start with the ninth film in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre franchise.
Yeah, it's the ninth one. Only the eighth I've seen.
Oh, which one?
One slipped past me there.
Which one was the new Leatherface?
There are two films called Leatherface. Uh-huh. I've only seen one of them.
Did you see the one with Viggo Mortensen or without Viggo Mortensen?
I saw the one from 1990.
That's the one with Viggo Mortensen.
This is the one with Viggo Mortensen.
Viggo's in the third one, right?
The one with the fourth one? That's the third one.
Yeah, he's in the third one. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, that's the one with all the shitty thrash metal on the soundtrack. Leatherface holds a little bit of trivia in film history in that it was the last feature film to be given an X rating by the Motion Picture Association before they retired the rating.
Yeah, 1990, they decided to switch it up from rated X to NC-17 in the hopes that X wouldn't carry the stigma. Oh, sorry, the NC-17 wouldn't carry the stigma that
the pornographic industry, kind of co-opted X-rated, and X-rated now means something different. They took on the NC-17 rating, still has a stigma, but
never quite caught on.
Like, porn hasn't adopted NC-17.
No,
but anyway, I've seen the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I saw, kind of recently, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, which was also by Tobe Hooper.
Yeah.
Which is sort of like the kookier, wilder version of the first one.
Let's go through them real fast.
That's what I was doing.
Well, but you also skipped ahead. The original Texas Chainsaw Massacre from the early 1970s, if you've never seen it, horror classic by Tobe Hooper, shot very, very low budget, very, very cheap. Mm. It is one of the scariest movies ever made, and it's really, really damn good, and it was very influential. It was very much based on the serial killings of Ed Gein, which serial killer also inspired Psycho and a lot of other famous movie serial killers. It took a long time for Tobe Hooper to make a sequel. Like, it was about 10 years before he did Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 in the 80s. Texas Chainsaw 2 is fucking weird.
It's very strange. The main character is like a radio DJ, and she's the one who's kidnapped by the murder family, but they now live in this weird, like, surreal carnival underground thing.
Yeah, they live, underneath an amusement park, and they turn it into this horrible, you know, mutant hellscape, and they're making their money by winning chili cook-offs, which, by the way...
and then they contain human meat.
Of course they do.
That's the shtick. It was 12 years between the first and the second films.
Dennis Hopper is in it, and he gets to do a chainsaw duel Evil with Leatherface, which is pretty fucking awesome, actually. I love Texas Chainsaw 2. Texas Chainsaw 2 is a totally different entity, but it's awesome.
Yeah, it's a lot more... like, it still has, like, the grim, ultra-violent stuff, yeah. But it doesn't feel grimy like the first one did. It's actually, like, really sort of colorful and slick. Yeah, 1990 came along. Leatherface, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3 is... generic and bland and not worth your time.
It's very violent. If that's what you want from a horror movie, you'll get a lot of violence. That's where one of the more famous lines in the franchise, "The Saw is family," comes from. Mm. But
Then there was 1995's The Texas Chainsaw Massacre: The Next Generation, which was shelved and then released a couple of years later when the two stars, Renee Zellweger and Matthew McConaughey, became really, really big.
Yeah, both of them, they ironically, they'd both been in Dazed and Confused. Mm-hmm. And then they were picked up to do this very campy version of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It looks like it's like a play that like Divine would go see in a John Waters movie.
Yeah,
like it's very strange.
If you like hillbillies screaming at each other for an hour and a half, this is the movie for you.
And it turns out I do.
It is hard to watch.
I actually enjoy it's that so one. Bad. I enjoy how completely over the top and ridiculous that one is. I actually
it's
find
not
it
ridiculous. It's just grating and unbearable.
But what's interesting about and when you can see it just in those first four, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre movies. They don't belong together. Like, none of them...
There's no solid continuity between the three.
And not even continuity. There's no tonal continuity. Like, they feel like they're made by entirely different people. The only thing they have in common is family of cannibals living in the South, and there's a chainsaw. Leatherface is usually in it, but not necessarily. Like, well, it's just...
And Leatherface isn't necessarily the same person each time. Just, there is a character named Leatherface in each one. So-called because they have constructed variously throughout a mask made of human skin.
Yeah.
And that's kind of it.
Yeah.
Who Leatherface is, the function they serve in this family. Like, they're the family
that varies
dynamic,
depending on
is always kind of the same, but it's not the same characters each time. No.
Then a few years later, we started to have the big remake boom in the 2000s. And if memory serves...
This one was one of the ones that kicked it off.
Yeah, the remake of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which everyone's like, "What? Really? You're gonna do that?" Marcus Nispel directed it, produced by Michael Bay's production company. It did really well, and it has a lot of huge fans. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's as good as the original, but I've grown to appreciate the remake's impossibly bleak nihilism.
Well, that was really par for the course for a lot of horror films in the early 2000s, and this one was. Setting and also kind of perpetuating a trend of this kind of bleakness that was going throughout a lot of horror movies. And a lot of the remakes you'll find from that era were pretty assertively bleak.
Mm-hmm.
There was a remake of The Hills Have Eyes and The Hills Have Eyes Part 2. And
yeah,
those are both just like
very punishing,
dour torture movies. There's a lot of torture going on in the early 2000s. So a lot of these remakes played into that. So it's just sort of... doesn't have the same sort of homemade griminess.
No, it's very slick. It's actually from the same cinematographer, and you could never tell. He's done completely different things from the original and the remake, but they're gorgeous movies.
Hmm. A lot of blood and screaming. One was such a big hit that they did a prequel to the remake.
Uh-huh, to explain the origin of that family and...
how they came to start eating people to begin with.
That's a very forgettable film. The only thing I remember very distinctly about that movie, and I don't have the exact number in front of me, but at the beginning of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, in the original and the remake, there is a voiceover by John Larroquette, of all people. Night Court and the John Larroquette Show.
He did it for the original, and whenever they made a new one, it was like, hey, you want to come in to the booth for an hour and just read these lines?
He did it for the new one, too. So, yeah. Good for him. Like, he's stayed true to his roots. But in any case, that opening narration says that this family killed, I forget how many people, like 14.
650.
No, it's not that many. It's like...
I know.
It's like 13 or 14 people, which is a lot, but don't get me wrong. But it's not like this giant... body count you'd expect from a horror franchise.
Some days I barely kill anybody at all. Some days I just can't stop.
Well, I watched the Texas Chainsaw Massacre at the beginning, and the body count is really high in that movie. Mm-hmm. And I realized that according to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre at the beginning, they did almost no other killing. It's just the killing in those two movies. That franchise is dead. They've accounted for pretty much every death that they've mentioned in that opening monologue. I thought that was really hilarious.
Mixed in with all of this is like an unofficial Texas Chainsaw homage that Rob Zombie made in House of 1000 Corpses.
Is, oh, it's
very, very, very heavily influenced by Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
The Devil's Rejects even more so, I think.
Well, the idea that there's a murder family, including a gigantic simpleton who wears a human skin mask, is a big part of House of 1000 Corpses.
Sure.
There's also a cyborg named Dr. Satan. And, there's all kinds of crazy shit in that movie.
Yeah, I wish we'd bring Dr. Satan back. He moved away from Dr. Satan. I'm like, you coward. then they brought in Texas Chainsaw 3D, which has massive continuity problems in that it's supposed to take place 20 years after the original, but everyone has smartphones. It's they kind of forgot what year it takes place. So there's a whole sequence where someone has a smartphone and they shouldn't. Apart from that, that's a very enjoyable film.
It actually has a lot of energy. It bothers to tell a story. It feels like a real movie, which is rare for the Texas Chainsaw movies, because the original is actually deliberately very low concept.
Yeah.
Just people wander into a house of murder cannibals and they get murdered and cannibalized.
Yeah, that's the power of it. That's the power of it. It feels like just stuff that happens and there's something really freaky about it.
I've heard it described thus that it feels like it was made by cannibals.
Yeah.
Even the film stock looks like it's been in a slaughterhouse. That rawness is where it gets a lot of its power.
Yeah.
But by the time we get to Texas Chainsaw 3D, they're like, hey, maybe we can
make it slick.
Make a movie about this. Make it actually about...
Create it like a film.
Characters with story beats and a plot and acts and all the rest, because that's really uncommon for this film series.
Yeah, and then that didn't take off, and then we had a barely eked out prequel. I think officially it's only a prequel to the original, or it might be a prequel to Texas Chainsaw 3D, but whatever. It's a prequel called Leatherface, again, just to confuse you.
The titles are plenty confusing.
Stars Steven Dorff and other people. That movie is terrible. That movie...
That's the one I missed.
As far as I'm concerned, that's the worst in the franchise. Because that particular movie, which is about how, two of the kids in the Sawyer family, that's the name of the family, cannibals, got taken away from their family, and they got taken to an orphanage, and then they broke out and killed a bunch of people. It doesn't feel like it's from Texas Chainsaw. It feels like it was made by people who saw stuff Texas Chainsaw inspired. So it feels three generations removed. It's a little bit of Natural Born Killers. It's a little bit of Devil's Rejects. And nothing about it carries really anything to do with Texas Chainsaw other than a little bit of plot. It just comes across as this really low budget, ultra-violent fugitive thing that really didn't have to be called Texas Chainsaw. And on top of that, I don't think it's very good. I don't think it's well-written. I don't think it's well-acted. It's a frustrating film for me.
Apart from Stephen Dorff and Lily Taylor's in that, too.
Oh, that's right. Lily Taylor's in that. She's good in it. Actually, I forgot about Lily Taylor for a second. She's good, but she's not in it.
Those two are typically both very good in what they're in.
Yeah, but it's not their story. It's probably the story of these two hunky teens who are driving around killing people. It's not good. So we're back, and we are once again, for the umpteenth time, we are making a sequel to the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I think this might be the fourth sequel to the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, to ignore all the other movies.
There's no continuity in any of these.
There's the original movie and then other stuff.
Yeah, just other things that sort of draw from the same premise. And this one is... Drop the. It's cleaner. This one is just... Texas Chainsaw Massacre without the
also worth noting, the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre title, Chainsaw, was two words.
Chainsaw Massacre. Except on the poster where it was one. So
well,
was
they showed the poster.
A little bit muddled. But
I think the poster got redone multiple times because it had many posters. Right. So I think after a while they just dropped it. Yeah, but the original title is Chainsaw.
So if you pay attention to sort of the spacing in the articles, you can kind of tell these films apart.
Kerning is everything in Texas Chainsaw.
If you watch the movies, you can also kind of tell them apart. They're all very similar. The premise this time around is trying to be quite topical, not very well, but it involves Instagram influencers, wealthy young tech millennials who have decided to buy a whole small town in Texas and gentrify
it.
Gentrify a ghost town and turn it into this hot hipster area.
Yeah.
They want it to be the next Austin. Here's what you do. You need to get Leatherface, and you put him in Austin, and you have him kill people in Austin. That's the Texas Chainsaw Massacre you need to satirize these Instagram influencers.
Leatherface attacks South by Southwest.
Perfect.
Awesome. There's your movie.
The South by Southwest Chainsaw Massacre.
Later in this episode, we're going to review a film that I've been in my head referring to as South by Southwest the movie. So we'll talk about that in a minute. But
These young millennials are very... They're clearly being built to be kind of hated.
Yeah.
So when they finally get slaughtered by Leatherface, you kind of are eager to watch them die.
But I think that's significant because it marks a distinct transition here between Texas Chainsaw trying to do its own thing, being super weird, and then this new Texas Chainsaw Massacre is, we're a slasher movie now. That's
We're introducing
a bunch of people
and,
that you won't mind getting murdered. We're going to murder them in really creative ways, and then that's the film. It's really uncomplicated.
And this one is also unique in that Leatherface is... Because it's, you know, that sort of slasher mold now has a little bit of the Righteous Kill about him.
Yeah, he's wrong here.
There's an element of that to most slasher films that they, you know, if you watch enough slasher films or you listen to people talk about them, you notice the tropes about how the characters who take drugs or have sex early in the movie are then, like, karmically punished by the killer.
And the killer is usually they're going way overboard, obviously, but they're usually someone who was wronged in some way. Teenagers let them drown because they were having sex. There was a horrible prank that went terribly wrong and it nearly killed them, that kind of thing. They burned my house down with me in it. I mean, sure, I tried to kill their kids, but whatever, they're the real jerks.
And while there's plenty to be said about how the murder family in Texas Chainsaw Massacre is the result of a lot of... generations-long economic imbalance throughout the United States and how it affects rural areas, specifically in Texas.
The remakes really hammered that home in particular.
Especially the beginning is very specifically about that. It's about how they all lost their jobs at the local slaughterhouse. That's sort of like a thematic element. This is a lot more of a directly story element where Leatherface and Alice Creege.
Yay! Alice Creege, the Borg queen from First Contact.
The Borg queen, she was in Sleepwalkers.
She was in Gretel and Hansel, very underrated horror movie.
That's why she played the witch in that one.
Yeah, very underrated horror movie. Please check
that
out.
And here she plays the Leatherface's mom, and she and Leatherface
She runs an orphanage where basically the Texas Chainsaw Massacre happened in the early 70s, and then everyone disappeared. And then Leatherface is the last one who has never been found and arrested, killed, whatever. And turns out he's been hiding at this orphanage, and Alice Creege has been protecting him this whole time.
Yeah, and when these hipsters come in, they find her still living in the house. They thought they had bought everything and everybody had been evicted. She's still there and says, no, there was like, I made a deal. I figured it out, so I was able to stay here.
So they kick her out.
But they kick her out. They put her, and in so doing, she has some sort of attack, and they put her on an ambulance and drive her away.
Yeah. Leatherface gets in the ambulance. They don't know it's Leatherface yet.
Leatherface gets in the ambulance, and so the hipsters go about preparing the town. Meanwhile, in the ambulance, wouldn't you know it, Alice Creege dies, and Leatherface is now given license to put on a skin mask and kill everybody.
Apparently, Alice Creege was the only thing keeping him from murdering everyone in the world, and now that she's gone, here we go, basically.
There's also a subplot. One of the characters, played by Elsie Fisher from 8th grade.
Yeah. She's in another movie reviewing this week, actually.
She plays, and this is really badly handled.
Yeah.
She plays the survivor of a school shooting.
Yeah.
And is using this trip to sort of heal. Well, her sister is one of the Instagram.
Her older sister is behind this big scheme, and she wants to make sure that her younger sister. Someone's looking after her, so she's dragged along in this whole event. And I wouldn't say,
and it's not
that they do anything like horrifically wrong with that material, but using it as a generic backstory for a tortured character is in really poor taste.
It's in poor taste. It also speaks to how common those sorts of traumas are.
True.
And,
that's a good
point. The film is not doing anything, a lot of heavy lifting in terms of like trying to draw parallels between the trauma of her past and the trauma of her present.
No.
Just she experiences a lot of violence and then learns to do violence. And isn't that heroic?
I would argue that this film's biggest flaw is it keeps bringing up serious thematic things and has no idea how to talk about them.
No.
And indeed,
more so than any of the other movies, even the ones that are really sympathetic with the cannibal family, this one is like straight up don't mess with Texas kind of pro-gun politically. It's a very right-wing movie. And it's about how these sort of these left-wing city hipsters are, it's sort of like a revenge fantasy for people who hate those the big city hipsters.
And yet,
Leatherface is now being staged as this instrument of vengeance for Texas.
Yeah.
He is now Texas's hero.
Well, I think that's a slight exaggeration. It's kind of there.
That's the way they're presenting him.
I think if they really wanted to do that, they could have, and they could have gone really overboard with it, and it could have been really strong. Weird, maybe, in poor taste, but strong.
In fact,
but
I think the thing that sort of incurs everybody's wrath is when they try to remove a Confederate flag from one of the buildings. That is a pretty fraught image right now.
Agreed.
And it's always been a pretty fraught image, and that they included it in this film as the thing that instigates the action, as the central symbol that instigates the action, is significant. It's not part of this financial
plan. But I don't see it as something that's being defended. I see it as something like that's literally a red flag. That's like literally like, oh shit, don't go in that house, like that kind of thing. Like that's how I see your point. For me, what it boils down to, this whole movie, is all of the thematic stuff in it, which is mostly handled so superficially it barely registers, is secondary. And what we've really got here is an anti-capitalist screed where Leatherface kills a whole bunch of rich young entrepreneurs who want to exploit his town. Once the slaughtering begins, the slaughtering is really cool. Like, the slaughtering is really ecstatically violent in a way that, like, the movie's having fun with gore.
The gore is spectacular.
Yeah.
There's, blood. I love movies where the blood gets so thick on the floor, people slip on it.
Yeah.
That happens in this movie. There's just intestines spilling everywhere.
There's this great sequence where someone is trapped under the floorboards of a house, and Leatherface is, like, using a chainsaw, like an upside-down shark fin to chase after them. Like, that whole bit's great. There's a bit where he uses a chainsaw, almost like you would use in, like, a shuffleboard to, like, cut off someone's foot. Like, there's some amazing shit. Yeah. Like, there's some really, really good gore gags here. And I feel like some of it's handled poorly, but I feel like everything getting up there is basically just like, here's why it's okay to kill all these people. Because it's a slasher movie, and we're not, if Jason Voorhees lived in Texas, this would be the film. That's what we're reduced to. We don't have any big ideas anymore. It's basically just, we're going to give you an excuse to go, Leatherface is killing people, and I don't feel too bad. That's kind of it. We're sort of desensitizing.
What I find really curious is, just sort of looking at the long view of sort of building developers as villains in movies.
Sure.
That was really common throughout the 1980s. And the building developers were always seen as these, like, Reaganite, sort of up-and-coming yuppie types.
Yeah.
You'll think of, like, Daniel Clamp from Gremlins 2 is an example of that. Or any number of examples besides.
Yeah. The battery's not included is the example I always think of.
Yeah, there you go. We're going to buy your town, and we're going to put a shopping mall here. And
if you don't get out of there, we're going to hire local criminals to beat you up, that kind of thing,
Greedy landowners was a big common theme throughout horror films of the 1980s. And
honestly, just throughout history, greedy landowners are a lot of, and that's a lot of Westerns,
But what I find really curious is, it was always sort of like this Frank Capra-esque fighting the man a theme to those films in the 1980s. How it was the yuppies trying to buy out the local well-meaning townsfolk.
Yeah.
Your George Baileys. And then you fast forward to this new Texas Chainsaw, and now the bad guys are the ones on the extreme left. The wicked landowners have sort of changed hands all of a sudden. And the ones who are now defending it are sort of the ones who grew up in the Reagan era.
Maybe.
The political shoe is on the other foot with Texas Chainsaw.
You're right, but I do think the underlying basic message is that money corrupts.
Absolutely,
the fact that they have that much money.
I find it curious that we're getting the same story with a complete 180 on the political viewpoint.
Yeah, it is. It is weird to think about, though, because when you think about, like, a slasher villain, you were talking about how a lot of slasher villains have an element of the righteous to them.
Yeah,
like, I am entitled to these murders because you are karmically wrong. Mm.
Even if it's, basic moralizing, like, don't do drugs.
But it's also worth noting that because they're killing everybody, every single one of these slasher villains has a skewed moral compass. And that skewed moral compass could be simply a political line. You know, it could be conservative versus liberal. It could be Democrat versus Republican, for example. Like, you can have that be that sort of principled excuse for this completely irresponsible violence. I don't know. I guess I don't see that as being off limits.
Well, it's not off limits. You know, it's just sort of a curious way to see how horror films are evolving, and the sorts of people we use as sort of the raw meat in these movies, and the sorts of people we have as the killers and what they represent. And I mean, slasher films are in a way just sort of these like nihilistic violence fantasies, aren't they? We want to see violence done to people. Maybe we even have fantasies about doing violence, and the movies let us sort of have an outlet where we can sort of like see our fantasies realized, even our violent, most base fantasies. And I just find it odd that the fantasy seems to be changing. The fantasy changes as time changes. And it's kind of interesting to see it change over the course of a single film series.
Yeah.
It's easy for Texas Chainsaw to do that because it doesn't have any kind of like single solid continuity. They can restart it and do whatever they want with this series. So long as there's a big guy with a flesh mask killing people with a chainsaw.
Yeah, you kind of get away with it. In Texas. Yeah. I don't know. I was thinking about, like, there's another film that came out. It's not a slasher movie, but it's one of there aren't a lot of horror movies that are kind of taking aim at liberals. Get Out did. Very successfully, I feel. A movie that tried to have its cake and eat it, too, and portray, like, both liberals and conservatives as the whole world is kind of a joke. Everyone's full of shit. Was The Hunt.
Oh, there you
go. With Betty Gilpin.
I didn't see that. I heard
like a lot of people really didn't appreciate the jokes at the expense of liberals in that movie, whereas I think a lot of them actually landed pretty well. Because that whole movie is like it's like a Brian Trenchard Smith thing. Like everyone in it is a cartoon. So I can handle, you know, a couple of pot shots in my direction because everyone's getting hit with something. But yeah, this is just an incredibly... It's frustrating because I feel like if this had been focused, if this had actually, like, didn't just have, like, themes that pop up from the story, but actually, like, cared about some of them, this could actually have been a lot stronger. Maybe more irresponsible, depending on what tack they took. But it could have been a lot more focused. Because right now, it just feels like we just made a slick slasher, and if there was other shit in the script, we filmed it, but we didn't really do anything with it.
Yeah.
Again, it just feels the movie feels ignorant, but it's also a very entertaining slasher just on a pure fundamental. Here's a killer with a chainsaw level. I think on that level, if you can enjoy that, you can enjoy this film. And in fact, I actually think it's actually far from the worst in the franchise. A lot of people are saying, this is the end. And I'm like, oh my God, did you see Leatherface? What the hell?
This whole series has a really bad track record. I love the original a lot. That second one's really kooky, but
I can appreciate why people like the remake a lot. It's not my jam, but
And I enjoy Texas Chainsaw 3D, the one that's it's the closest to an actual movie we've gotten out of the series. The rest are all pretty trashy.
Yeah, they're all just all over the place. Whether you like them or not, they're all over the place. There's no consistency here. Inconsistency is the consistency, and I can't really get all up in arms about it.
It's certainly, by far, it's not the worst in this series.
Surely, I know some have been really mad about this movie, and again, there are really good reasons to be, but surely your standards have been lowered by now, right? If you care enough about Texas Chainsaw to have a strong opinion about it, surely you've seen the movies and you realize that we kind of need to take what we can get right now if we're going to get a Texas Chainsaw. And I think this is far from the worst thing we could get. Anyway, it's a mixed bag for sure, but I actually ended up appreciating it on a very superficial level.
All right. Saying it's not as bad as some of the worst films in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is pretty slight praise.
Like I said, standards have been lowered.
I think Texas Chainsaw Massacre: The Next Generation really is just utterly abysmal.
Oh, but it's fun though.
And it turns out that the murder family was part of this weird government conspiracy. Yeah,
they were working for the Illuminati the whole time.
Weird.
Seeing Renee Zellweger. Seeing Renee Zellweger. Just at, there's at some point in the movie where Renee Zellweger, he's been kidnapped, and he's seen all this horrible shit. And at one point, she just gets up and says, "Fuck it, I'm done." She just walks out, and Leatherface is like, "Aah!" And she's just like, "Sit your ass down now!" And Leatherface is like, "Sorry."
Like, she just leaves.
She just leaves. That's love her so much of that.
Matthew McConaughey has a mechanical leg
he's a cyborg with a
Nintendo controller.
He's
like
a cyborg. That's, oh my god, why do people not talk about that movie more? All right, anyway, that's it for Texas Chainsaw. Let's talk about a new thriller that's on Hulu that we both watched.
That's this week.
We're gonna bounce around.
This is for the last 2 weeks.
They're all out there. Texas Chainsaw is on Netflix. On Hulu, we have a new thriller called No Exit, which is a claustrophobic thriller about a young woman who is in rehab. She finds out that her mother is in the hospital and probably dying, so she breaks out of rehab, steals a car. But before she can get very far, there is a blizzard. She's trapped in the snow, and she has to basically wait out the storm
in a rest area, basically. She has to enact the film The Hateful Eight, which I can't comment on the film The Hateful Eight because I still work for the filmmaker.
But structurally, it's about a whole bunch of people who might have mysterious pasts who are trapped in a snowstorm.
Trapped in a snowy cabin. Yeah. There's even a cup of poison coffee.
If you want, I will go this far. I think they're all just ripping off the Sylvester Stallone movie Detox.
Oh, I didn't see Detox.
A.K.A. The Outpost. Sylvester Stallone plays a guy who was on the hunt for a serial killer. The serial killer killed his fiance or wife, I can't remember. He falls pretty hard into substance abuse. And he is checked into a rehab clinic run by, I think, Chris Christopherson.
Yeah.
Basically you're all isolated out in the middle of nowhere, no cell phones, no nothing. And it's a whole bunch of former cops and they're all being attacked by another serial killer. And the cast in that movie is absurd, by the way. Well,
this was sort of the golden age of, it was the '70s, you said, right?
No. This is the early 2000s.
Wait, what?
Yeah, this movie, nobody talked about this. Right. So it's Chris Christopherson, Tom Berenger, Charles S. Dutton, Polly Walker, Jeffrey Wright, Robert Patrick. This is all rock solid casting. We've got Stephen Lang, Courtney B. Vance, Sean Patrick Flannery, Dina Meyer.
Oh, I like her.
That's a good cast. Mm-hmm. And this movie nobody saw it. It's fine. It's not particularly good, but it's out there. And technically, it's the only horror movie Sylvester Stallone ever made. So, boom. Enjoy. But in any case, we're back in this format now where people are stuck in the snowstorm. There's probably a murderer out there. She's stuck in this rest area with a small group of potential suspects.
Yeah, if it were a little bit more ambitious, it would have been like 10 suspects. Turns out there's only 4.
Which is enough for a 90-minute movie, but
which means we're going to be in and out pretty quick. And they're also going to have to give away the truth pretty quick, because she can kind of narrow
down.
There's
only
so many
people it can be. So basically,
Daniel Ramirez, David Rysdahl, Dale Dickey, and Dennis Haysbert play the potential suspects.
Havana Rose Liu plays the lead, Darby.
And I just saw her in a film called The Sky Is Everywhere. She was like the star student that the main character was like constantly being bested by and ended up kind of developing a friendship.
Yeah, I like her a lot. So she goes out to try to find some cell phone reception so you can check in on her mom. And that's when she finds out that one of the people who is trapped in this rest area drives a van, and in the back of that van is a kidnapped young girl.
Ten-year-old girl tied up in the van, and
there's nothing she can do.
She doesn't know who drives the van, so she has to go in and just start eyeballing people.
Start asking questions.
She starts asking questions. The interrogation doesn't last very long. I think it should be the bulk of the movie where she's trying to figure it out.
This is a perfectly decent setup for a thriller, but I feel like this one should have been a half-hour Alfred Hitchcock Presents episode, where it's basically what happens is people are stuck in a rest area, someone goes outside, realizes that someone's kidnapped, they don't have a weapon, they can't call anybody, but they're trying to figure out who it is. And there's a big chunk of this movie where they're all playing cards at a table, And they're all and just
and they're
kind
playing
of feeling,
BS, so yeah. That's, you know, plays into
it. Bullshit, yeah. By the way, is a card game where everyone is dealt out the whole deck.
Yeah, you play cards face down, and you say what they are, yeah. and you can be bluffing, and yeah. If somebody calls your bluff.
You have to go in order. So he plays a two, then a four, and if you don't have a four, you have to lie. And if anyone knows you're lying because they've been keeping track or they have all the fours or whatever like that, they can say bullshit. And if that's the case, you pick up all the cards. And now the whole point is to get rid of all your cards. But now you have the whole deck in your hand. So it's basically a whole game that's based around the concept of bluffing from poker, which is a perfectly decent way to set up a suspense sequence where people are trying to figure out who's full of shit right now and who's potentially in danger. And I'm like, I kind of wish this had been the whole thing. Just like, trying to figure out over a poker game who here is a kidnapper. Like, that's a solid suspenseful premise, but we have to keep going. And I will say this. I don't think this movie outlasts its welcome. It's thin. Like, it's a thin premise. It's pretty straightforward. And there's definitely a temptation here to try to push it as far as it can go. And instead, I think they understand that we got limited space. Yeah, we got a limited budget, and we're just going to keep this humming along.
They clearly had a limited budget. I don't mind movies that have small casts and limited sets, especially if there's, you know, creative filmmaking. One of the conceits is the women's room in this rest stop is under construction, which avails potential weapons. Yeah. So that's kind of a fun creative conceit.
Also, potentially different entrance to the building.
We don't get a good sense as to sort of like the layout of the building. That would have been nice. You can have like hallways and chases.
Well, it's also a pretty small building. It's basically just a rest stop.
You can tell it's a really low budget, though, because the early scenes, we actually get to see her in rehab and how much trouble she's having when she gets the bad news. Takes a little 5 minutes too long. And she has to break out of rehab. And the car sequences that when she's driving away are like some of the worst CGI.
It looks like a cartoon. They're trying to do this like overhead shot. And it's like, yeah, no. In theory, that's a good shot. In practice, you needed more money on that shot.
The effects they used to realize the cars driving.
Honestly, it's the sort of thing that might have been better for this to air on Hulu because you're not necessarily watching it in the best presentation. The smaller TV, the better for this one, maybe, because on the big screen, they probably would have been really hard to hide.
I wish they had brought something kind of original to this. They reveal who the bad guy is before the halfway mark.
Well,
it's pretty soon in the movie.
You figure out, this is one of those movies where the biggest twist they can do is the red herring is the bad guy.
Yeah, kind of.
But then there's more to it. I will say this. There are some twists, including I thought there was, like, they keep referencing a character who I thought was going to show up and like, there's going to be a big twist about who this. No, that never happens. There's a few other twists.
Is he named Bruno?
Bruno. But there are twists. There are additional twists in this, but the first twist seems pretty obvious.
The twists aren't terribly clever, though.
No, they make sense. They're valid twists.
I feel like there could have been a lot more going on. There could have been extra characters. There was a lot more, even with a limited budget, there was a lot more ambition that could have been brought to this.
I was thinking,
as it stands, it's pretty pat.
Yeah.
Some of the violence is fun. I feel like the violence takes up too much time. And you know, after a while, when we finally sort of get down to sort of the last violent scenes and we see, like, the monstrous character finally be as monstrous as they're going to be, they're not really scary.
No.
I didn't feel that sort of, like, dread or suspense. They're just some violence.
I was thinking about it because I was watching this movie and I'm like, this is perfectly decent. This is not a bad movie. But I'm trying to figure out why isn't this great? Because there's nothing wrong with the screenplay, really. The cast is fine. The cast is excellent to doing their jobs perfectly well. I'm trying to watch it. What is the difference between this and maybe some of the breakout crime type movies that we'd seen in maybe the 80s and the 90s, something like Blood Simple or Bound, for example. And I was realizing that what's really missing here is a filmmaking personality. I'm not really getting from the, because this movie, again, this is an airplane novel.
Yeah,
this is, in fact, it's based on a novel. It's a pulpy thriller that you read for fun. There's some thrills in it, some suspense, a couple of twists, and then we're out the door. There's not much more to it than that. Nothing wrong with that whatsoever. but it's a little unambitious. The reason to make this into a movie is to have fun telling it. And I never get that Hitchcockian ambition in terms of how we're going to make the suspense play out. Yeah. I never get that Sam Raimi-ish, like, excitement about how we're going to do things visually. Mm-hmm. I don't get a sense of, like, a Barry Sonnenfeld-ish, like, sense of humor to it. What is the selling point here beyond just, this is a decent premise for a thriller? I don't see it.
The film I was going to compare it to was another film that we just saw recently that also makes use of a nail gun as a weapon.
Oh, yeah.
Steven Soderbergh's Kimmy.
Yeah.
Steven Soderbergh's Kimmy is great.
Really good film.
And Steven Soderbergh has a good sense of place and character and pacing. He adds a lot of little details that the audience is kind of looking for and reading. You're engaged in a certain kind of way that we don't have here. There aren't little clues dropped around. The characters, frankly, are pretty off the rack. Yeah. There's not some sort of quirk about them. And this is no fault of the actors. I actually like the cast.
Yeah.
There's just not, like, anything that's too unique about them.
No, there's
nothing too unique enough about the screenplay.
Somewhat archetypal, yeah.
Yeah. The characters are archetypal. The story is archetypal.
Yeah. But it's told with verve.
There's no filmmaking panache.
Yeah.
There's no element, like, of creativity that the filmmaker is bringing into.
And no exit.
And no, that's
and Kimmy,
no,
we're saying it.
Kimmy,
there,
it is. That's why Kimmy is such a quirker, and this one kind of isn't.
And to be fair, I think you can go too far in the other direction. I think the reason why the film Bad Times at the El Royale didn't really
Quirk Overdrive.
Yeah, because that movie is, the plot of that movie, tell me the plot of that movie, I fucking dare you. Like, there's so many characters, and there's so many different plot lines, that it's kind of hard to get a read on what's happening. You can remember different individual elements, but keeping track of it all, it's kind of a futile exercise. Mm. The whole point of that movie is to basically brandish as many cinematic tricks as I think it was Drew Goddard who did that one, right? As they can. And there's a lot of really memorable shots and exciting, like, camera reveals and flashbacks to tell stories and things. And all those things are really, really fun, but they're hiding the fact that the movie itself, the story itself, needs all of that to work, because without it, it would be preposterous. Here, we needed more of a balance, I think, and I think that would have taken this thing from pretty good, not a bad film, No Exit, totally worth seeing if you like thrillers, and you got 90 minutes, but there's definitely something holding it back from being truly great, and I just think that it needs that energy from a filmmaker who just knows how to tell a story in a distinct way, and is really excited to do so. And I just feel instead we got something that was perfectly decent, very accomplished, very workmanlike, but never stands out. There's no reason to go, oh my God, you got to see this.
Yeah.
Instead, we can say, if you enjoy thrillers, this is fine.
It's fine. It's fodder. It's the background. It's the bottom shelf of Blockbuster. Two stars, 5 out of 10. There's really nothing extraordinary about it. And that's not something I can feel passionate about one way or the other.
I'd give it a little higher than that, because I think it's fine.
Doesn't mean, like, it's a recommend. It's
more like a 2.5-star, 3-star for me, but regardless, it's fine. Yeah.
Professionally made. It's not apart from the car stuff, it's not incompetent.
Yeah.
And it's watchable. It's not one of those things that, you know, will really rub you the wrong way. I like Dennis Haysbert a lot.
He's great.
Always a pleasure to see Dennis Haysbert.
Dale Dickey is a great actor. People don't talk about it. She doesn't get enough credit, honestly.
Yeah, and she was really great in this, and we got, like, one scene of backstory, which I really liked with her. But it's kind of a pity that it didn't do much of anything besides.
Yeah. Anyway, tell me about... Let's shift gears a little bit here.
All right.
There's a dog movie.
There is a dog movie.
Tell me about the movie with the dog in it.
The movie with the dog in it is called Dog.
Well, that tracks.
It's about a big, fluffy, lovable animal and a dog. The big, fluffy, lovable animal is Channing Tatum. Thank you. Channing Tatum, who stars in this movie and also co-directed.
Didn't know that. That's funny.
Channing Tatum is one of the directors with Reed Carolyn. The story is he plays an ex-soldier who's trying to get back into the military, but he's been injured. He's not allowed back in for mental reasons. Mm. And if he can pull off this one mission, this one favor for a fallen comrade of his, then he might be able to get back in. The mission is his comrade has fallen, and his trained battlefield attack dog has to be accompanied to his funeral. It's currently at an army base, and his funeral is several states away. And so he has to go on a road trip with this dog. The dog is traumatized, however, and has to wear a muzzle. Can't really be put out near people. It will attack at the sign of a, you know, when provoked, and you know, can't touch its ears. It'll attack people. And over the course of this road trip, Channing Tatum learns to bond with the animal, learns to see that the animal has, you know, like sort of a lot of personality, and kind of they use their presence in each other's company to sort of mutually heal.
So we're just sort of combining the road trip movie and the guy and his dog movie.
This is the same story as Sonic the Hedgehog. You know, this is there's a complete Pat storytelling here, and it's also has a really, really, really laid back quality. It's almost a stoner movie.
Okay,
and how like little drive and direction this movie has.
That's not necessarily a bad
thing. It's actually like quite relaxing.
Okay,
so the trauma really, really underplayed. The pain and suffering really, really underpaid. There's a lot of sort of little vignettes where they stop that are really kind of cliched.
They stop at the world's biggest ball of twine.
No, but he's like this like stern military guy, and he has to drive through Portland. He's like, okay, we're going to take a break in Portland. And he goes into a Portland bar to try to like pick up girls. And they're all like, oh, so how does it feel to murder for the state? And he's like, well, shit, I thought I'd have some more luck here. And he ends up like going to this like almost having a threesome with these two like tantric studies women who are like going to heal him through sexual powers. Like, yeah, I like this. He's a complete meathead.
That's hilarious.
There's a comedic bit, which seems like out of a Tom and Jerry movie where he pretends to be blind and the dog is his guide dog. So he can get a free hotel room in a fancy hotel.
Oh, that sounds terrible.
And you know, he's of course taken to task for this.
Well, good. Cause that's fucked up. That doesn't compare to, I'm reminded, I'll let you go.
But no, just, and through all of these vignettes, and he's also talking about, like, trying to reunite with his ex-wife and his daughter, who he's estranged from.
Yeah.
We see his wife in one scene. She has no lines. She's played by the actress Koryanka Kilker.
The New World.
From The New World, yeah. Okay. She played Pocahontas in The New World, and she's a really great actress.
She is.
I don't know why they hired her and just cut all her scenes. There was more there.
One can only imagine.
This movie feels like a lot was cut out along the way, just because there's a lot of jumps in logic.
Interesting.
And because of that relaxed attitude, it feels like there's nothing at stake here.
Yeah.
Like, okay, he's going to deliver the dog or not. There's not a big weepy moment. There's not a lot of emotions. It's really just sort of laid back. And that's a fine way for a film to function.
Sure.
If you're looking for a film to be a balm and to sort of relax you a little bit, this will hit the spot. But it's not even like sort of cute and lovey in a dog film ordinarily is.
Yeah.
Even the dog is sort of like laid back.
And it's not like a super depressing dog film like Marley and Me.
What's at stake here is if after the funeral, Channing Tatum delivers this dog, and then he has to deliver the dog to another army base where it's going to be put to sleep.
Aww.
So that's part of his mission. It's like, okay, take this dog to a funeral and then execute the dog.
No, that's bullshit. No, don't do it, Channing.
Because they can't, you know, they can't kill the dog. The dog is attacking people.
Channing, it's not too late to change it. I know how it ends. If it ends badly, it's not too late to change it, Channing. Make sure the dog's okay.
I think there are even some posters that say, see dog, the dog is okay.
Yeah, like,
the dog doesn't die.
There's a trailer where it says, there's like, rated PG-13. Don't worry, the dog doesn't die. In theaters on Friday. Like, they say it in the trailer. It's not a spoiler. They want people to know. Like, they don't want to attract it. They don't want to, like, people not to come because they're afraid of what the movie's going to do.
The dog, quite frankly, looks a little weird to me. Like, the breed of dog that they chose, like, has this kind of rodent look to it. It looks like a coyote.
Okay.
Which, you know, ordinarily in these movies, you get sort of like a big lovable dog, something you can hug.
Yeah.
This one's kind of like wiry and scary looking to me.
Well, do you remember Max? This is the movie I was kind of thinking of when you're talking about how the dogs. Like,
yeah, Max is a big huggable dog.
Yeah, Max
and
is a movie.
It's really similar to Max because Max is another story about a dog that is suffering from battlefield trauma.
Yeah, the Max, if you recall, made money. Max was a story about a dog who was enlisted in the military, and his handler dies, and the dog is considered pretty much like useless to the army, and it ends up going to that guy's family who are also traumatized. Their son died, and they're going through a lot right now, and 2/3 of that movie is a very serious story about healing. Mm. There's a really horrible sequence, like horrible in like an intended way, where like the dad is like hates this dog so much because he represents like, why are you alive and my son is dead, that kind of shit. And then it ends in like a Steven Seagal movie because there's like drug runners in town and the mad dog has to help and be a soldier and stuff. And it's really fucking weird. And then there was a sequel.
I didn't see Max 2.
Max 2 White House Hero. Max 2 White House Hero went straight to video, and it is probably the very first film to, you know, like in movies where they have to show the president, but it's a fictional president, but it's contemporary. So they try to make the president seem kind of like the president we've got in the White House now.
Right.
Like, it looks a little bit like George H.W. Bush, or it looks a little bit like Barack Obama. This was probably the first one to make the president look and feel a little bit like Donald Trump.
Wow.
The plot of the movie is the dog, part of the Secret Service detail, is on maternity leave.
The dog is on maternity
leave. So they have to re-enlist Max.
Oh, no!
And Max ends up befriending, essentially, Baron Trump.
Wow.
And ends up hanging out with Baron Trump and at a big peace conference between Trump and Putin.
Oh, wow, I gotta see this now in 2022.
The Baron Trump kid and Putin's, like, adorable daughter start having, like, this kind of, like, you know, middle school romance, and the dog helps those two kids, the kids of Trump and Putin, make sure that Trump and Putin can declare world peace. That's the fucking movie. The movie is insane. The movie is living in a complete fantasy world where everything was like normal in the Trump White. It came out like the year Trump was elected. Exactly. They had no idea yet. It's fucking incredible. It's such a weird film. You need to see it. They completely forgot about all the intensity of the original Max, and they just turned it into this weird Air Bud kind of vibe. It's super fucking weird.
God. No intensity in the movie Dog.
Okay.
Channing Tatum as a director seems to have taken a lot of cues from not Magic Mike, but Magic Mike XXL.
Oh, okay.
Which is a movie about how fun it is to have fun. It's that movie's about it's nothing. There's nothing going on in that movie. It's just fun to watch these guys dance and earn money and do fun things and hang out.
I'm embarrassed I've never seen that movie. I need to see that movie.
We're going to go on a road trip for our last dance, and we're going to stop and dance along the way and have a lot of fun dancing. And what happens? They do that. That's the story of the movie.
For me. They made that movie for me, and I still haven't watched that.
There's a really amazing, amazing scene where Joe Manganiello, who's from the first one too, feels like he's lost his mojo.
Yeah.
It's like, I just can't seduce women anymore with my dancing. And they're at like a rest stop. They're on the road trip getting gas. He's like, well, you know what? I see a woman in the rest stop. She's the clerk. She's the one selling them chips and stuff. Like, go dance. Go do what you do. And he does it. He goes in, he does this whole dance routine. He pulls bottles of water and pours them over himself.
Yeah.
And the clerk is just sort of like completely unimpressed. Just like a little bit creeped out by what's going on. And he rips off his shirt and he's like sexy hunk of meat, Joe Manganiello. And then he just leaves. He's like, yeah, still got it. He gets no reaction from her at all. That's the vibe I'm getting from Dog. It's like, let's just hang out and have a good time.
That is not a bad aesthetic for a director to have. That's a totally... we need movies like that. So, good for them. Let's see. What do we got here? Why don't you tell me about... why don't you tell me about The Cursed? So, while we're on dog movies.
Well, this is a werewolf movie.
Close enough.
The Cursed is a werewolf movie. It takes place in... takes place in late 19th century. I think it's an American colony, and maybe it's a British colony. But a lot of
colonial times,
a lot of colonialists have sort of their little little village, and wouldn't you know it, there's also there's a local Roma village nearby, and would you know, the colonialists just want to harass them for racist reasons. And in an incredibly harrowing single lockdown shot from the perspective of the leader of the colonialists, we see the colonialists run in, murder, assault, and burn down the village in a single take.
Wow.
just single lockdown shot from this, and it's like impeccably choreographed, where you see like little bits of action all throughout the screen. It's like a violent pillaging version of a Jacques Tati shot. This is a great looking movie. Just sort of the weird haze and a lot of the monster stuff is really cool. One of the horrible things they do is they find the sort of the two leaders of the Roma village. One guy, they cut off his hands and feet, stuff them with straw, and put him up as a scarecrow.
Oh God!
And the other one, they bury alive right by his feet. You commit an act of violence like that, you're going to incur a curse, because that's what happens is they bury a woman alive, and she's buried with this set of silver sort of werewolf teeth with like little little runes etched on them.
Right.
And shortly after this act of violence goes down, the colonialist children all begin dreaming about it. And they'll begin dreaming about the teeth, and they sort of gather in this sort of ethereal way to this gravesite, which they didn't witness, and they dig up the teeth. One of them puts them in, is suddenly like weirdly possessed, bites another one of the kid and one of the other kids. The werewolf curse has begun.
Okay. Based on a true story.
Well, I mean, you may as well. This sort of violence did happen.
No, not the historical violence. I didn't mean that. I just mean... You got to start the werewolf curse somewhere, I guess. It's always a little elaborate.
Well,
and
you know, the sort of connection to the Roma community and werewolfism, you know, goes back at least to the Wolfman.
Yeah,
the 1941 film, that is. And, yeah. And you know, of course, it's a story of cultural vengeance, isn't it? How this werewolf is sort of like stalking around and taking out its victims. This is one of those horror films where nobody is safe. You're not really sure. Yeah. When you think somebody is actually, we've been following them for a long time, and you think that
surely this person will be fine. They're the protagonist, and they're decent.
We've been following this person for the bulk of the film, and oh no, they're taken out all of a sudden. So that's always if you can strike the balance right, that's a good way to keep the audience off balance.
If you can do that without feeling like you're constantly betraying the audience, it's tricky. But that's cool.
Or like there's no stakes. Let me look up the cinematographer. Sean Ellis wrote, directed, and shot this movie.
Oh, wow.
Some of these sort of gorgeous, hazy exteriors, I would compare almost to Sleepy Hollow.
That's a compliment. Movie.
Think of like a daytime version of Sleepy Hollow, where everything's just sort of hazy and sort of this really dreadful atmosphere.
We've talked about this before, because there aren't a lot of truly great werewolf movies. How is this as a werewolf movie in terms of how it tackles werewolf as an idea, as a theme?
The myth is simultaneously a little oblique, because like the actual rules are never laid out. Mm. And at the same time, it's really kind of predictable. Who's the werewolf? Well, it kind of doesn't really matter who the werewolf is, because it's really easy to figure out. And there's this sort of Van Helsing character, this investigator, is trying to figure out who the werewolf is. So there's a lot of scenes of him suspiciously examining people with bite marks and saying, no, there's something really wrong is happening here.
Right.
And that's more designed to let the dread grow than to introduce new kinds of like double backs or elements to the werewolf curse.
Got it.
I'm willing to forgive a lot of banality if the filmmaking is strong.
Okay.
And I feel like in The Curse, the filmmaking is strong.
Kind of the opposite problem we had with
with No Exit.
The filmmaking is strong enough that you can forgive that it's kind of, which is my point.
Yeah.
If the filmmaking was stronger in No Exit, it would be a lot more forgivable. Yeah.
Yeah. If they were doing something incredibly stylish, or it was really, really atmospheric, or they're taking time with like some interesting character stuff. The characters do move in sort of a mass in this movie. I feel like nobody really emerges as like the one standout hero or villain. We do get a few good glory shots of the werewolf, and the werewolf is very odd looking. It's unlike werewolves I've seen in the past. That's exciting. Sort of like this lanky, hairless thing that almost doesn't look like a wolf. It just looks like a monster.
Well, that still sounds scary.
And it plays fair with the monster in that it doesn't show it too much. That's always that can be death for a monster movie if you see it all the time.
Yeah, you don't want it to lose its specialness.
Yeah.
It's not about like, you know, you want to have a couple of good glory shots of the thing, unless the point is you never see it.
Yeah.
You want to at least get like one or two good shots of the monster. So like, ooh, that was worth the wait. Yeah. But like, you also, if you show it constantly, it just becomes that thing in the room. It's not like, oh God, that.
Yeah.
You don't get used to it.
I always hate movies or scenes in horror movies where somebody like gears up with a lot of guns to take on the monster, or you know,
it's a cliche.
It's a big cliche. It also just shows that if the monster can be taken out by a gun, then it's not really that scary a monster anymore, is it?
Well, that's why I love when Sam Raimi does that in the Evil Dead movies, because they'll do that and then it doesn't work very well.
Yeah.
It actually works really bad.
It works because Ash is a complete buffoon in those movies. Or another one where, like, the giant monster is running amok through a city and they call in the military. It's like, I don't want to see a tank take out a giant grasshopper.
Yeah.
I want the giant grasshopper to just trash everything. We are helpless against the giant grasshopper. Don't even bother calling the military. It's dull. Godzilla is the only one that can still get away with that. So they sort of are really coy with the monster, that they don't really lay out something really clear that needs to happen. Yes, if you shoot him with, you know, stab him with this or shoot him with this, then he'll be dead. No, it's just about how the vengeance will play itself out and how everybody's just pretty much fucked. And I admire that.
That sounds really good.
So yeah, I liked The Cursed. I thought it was cool. It was pretty strong. Strong as werewolf movies go.
Nice. Well, my next film that I'm going to review is a horror comedy, and this is the one I was talking about when I said it's South by Southwest, the movie. Because this very much feels... If you're not familiar with South by Southwest, it's a film festival in Austin, Texas. And there's a lot of really good movies that have come out of there. But although the occasional, like, really strong drama will come out of South by Southwest, they're usually best known for, like, finding weird, quirky stuff. Mm. Like, lots of eccentric genre films, that kind of thing. Yeah. And so, a film in which the Foo Fighters play themselves as they're recording an album in a house with, like, a devil's altar underneath. And they find themselves composing, like, this 45-minute rock ballad to Satan that will open up a gate to hell and kill us all. That's very South by Southwest. That's not quite the plot, but it's close. Studio 666 is a film. It is directed by B.J. McDonnell, and it's based on a story by Dave Grohl. Apparently, Dave Grohl's story is, okay, so we're hanging out in this house, and we're making an album, I start going insane and killing all my band members.
That is the Foo Fighters playing ourselves.
Yeah.
Are hanging out in a house. Yeah.
Foo Fighters, by the way, kudos to the Foo Fighters for, like, being around for, like, 20 fucking years now.
Oh, hell yeah. And
like,
Dave Grohl is such a genial, charismatic fellow.
So nice. Like, I mean, I've never met him, but, like, he has this great persona where he came out of Nirvana. He was the drummer for Nirvana, and then, obviously, Kurt Cobain died, and that was a tragedy, but, like, he took some time, and then he built his own rock band, and that rock band is, they got great tunes, they got a great sense of humor, their music videos are really inventive and fun. He directed a pretty decent rock documentary called Sound City about, like, 5 years ago, which is about the history of this one, like, recording space, and all the different people who recorded it. It's quite good. He always just seems affable and happy to be there. And that's totally the vibe of Studio 666. Studio 666 is a film that was made during the pandemic. Dave Grohl and the Foo Fighters play themselves. And they have to record, I think it's their, like, 10th studio album or whatever it is. And they're like, we want to do it special. Like, hey, remember when Led Zeppelin recorded an album, recorded in a castle with, like, wizards and dragons and shit? And they're like, yeah, we got to do that. So they go record in a building where, like, there used to be this, like, one, like, big band that, like, died under mysterious circumstances on the grounds. And they're going to record there. One of the roadies immediately gets electrocuted to death. And Dave Grohl's like, no, we have to finish the album in this guy's honor. So they're all hanging out. Dave Grohl finds this, like, horrifying, like, ritual space in the basement that also has, like, a bunch of, like, recordings people have made in the past, and he starts kind of plagiarizing them because he's got what he calls a musical constipation.
Writer's block.
Like, he's like, okay, guys, I wrote a great new riff, and they're just like, that's This Is a Call. Okay, well, what about this one? That's Big Me. You've written these. He can't think of his own songs. He starts gradually turning more and more evil. The song gets longer and longer and longer. And by the end of the film, the Foo Fighters are all being brutally murdered. and it's cute.
Right, so Dave Grohl is murdering his own bandmates in some this movie?
Some of them get murdered in other ways, but most of them get murdered by Dave Grohl, yeah.
What's going on with the Foo Fighters?
I don't know, but they all seem game. They all seem, here's the deal, they all seem happy to be there.
Okay.
They all, here's what, you know what they're doing is they're all playing, there's one of my favorite music videos. It's not a great song, it's a cute song, but it's not a great song. Is for Backstreet's Back by the Backstreet Boys. And okay. If you've never seen this music video, you must.
I only saw it for the first time recently.
Yeah, so. It's a very cute music video. The whole idea is the Backstreet Boys are in a van. The van breaks down, and they have to spend the night in a haunted castle. And while they're in the haunted castle, each one of them gets turned into a sexy version of a classic monster, and they dance. It's the whole fucking thing.
They're back, I hear.
It's great. It's wonderfully well designed, but that opening bit where they're all just like really cutesy, funny versions of themselves. No one's pretending to be a good actor, and it's like, well, I guess we gotta stay in this haunted castle, you guys. I don't know. Like that's the level of acting we've got in Studio 666. It's all very dippy, very broad. One of the members of the band is like playing himself. I don't know how true this persona this is. I don't follow them well enough. Maybe this is playing off of something people know. Mm. But one of the members of the band is like all into new age shit, and like when they find like a disemboweled corpse in their backyard, he's like listening to the vibes of the corpse, like this corpse has been here for 2 days. That's what the vibes are telling me. One of the guys, is it Rami Jaffe? No, not him. Pat Smear has been with the band for forever. He's a huge dork, and like everyone gets a room at the house except him, so he sleeps in the kitchen so he can be closer to the snacks. By the way,
sounds like a Scooby-Doo episode.
It is. Yeah. It's a Scooby-Doo thing, but with ultra violence. There's a chainsaw kill in this movie that is fucking epic. Like, gigantically epic chainsaw kill that I've never quite seen before, and it's huge. And I had to applaud in my chair. This movie stars, in descending order of screen time, the Foo Fighters.
Uh-huh.
Doritos.
Contractor Noel. I will not bow to any sponsor.
And comedian Whitney Cummings. Doritos are in about half the scenes. They are constantly eating Doritos. Doritos are placed lovingly in various shots. I half expected Doritos to save the day at the end. There's so many goddamn Doritos in this movie. I'm reminded of when Joan Crawford married like the president of PepsiCo, and then every single movie she was in prominently featured Pepsi. I was like, did Dave Grohl marry someone from...
from Doritos? From,
actually, PepsiCo. Oh, from, yeah. They own Doritos. Like, did he marry into Pepsi? Did someone in this business, like, marry... Because that's the only explanation I've got here, because they're everywhere. This movie is very funny. I laughed at this, at the goofy things. I like that every time the Foo Fighters agree to do something, they're excited about it. They yell, Pearl Jam high five! And they all high five like what's the album, 10. Right. I knew it was a number. Yeah, it's all like the cover of 10. They're all like high fiving, and then they just say, "Yeah, we're still alive!" Like boom, adorable.
Which is a Pearl Jam song.
Yeah. That's adorable. Every single time they do that, that's adorable. It's like if William Castle directed A Hard Day's Night. Like that's the kind of vibe we're getting here, and that's very, very charming. The problem with this movie, and it's a big, big problem. It does not need to be 2 hours long.
Oh, no.
This is an 80-minute.
85 minutes with credits.
85. Yeah. There's another minor problem, but like that. This one's like the thing. Like I was laughing my ass off. I was having a really, really good time for a solid hour. And by about 90 minutes in, I realized that I'm just not laughing that much anymore. I'm kind of tapped out. They're not doing anything different. The kills are getting more elaborate, and that's fine. But ultimately... you shot your shot. Like you we're done now. We get what you did, and we're ready to go home. That's the problem. The other thing I think is a big missed opportunity is we've got the Foo Fighters in a movie about making a Foo Fighters album. Why isn't this a musical? Or at the very least, why are there not more songs?
Is there at least like one new hit single
something? Not a hit single. They do like play this like gigantic, like epic, like 45. They don't do the whole thing, but like this 45-minute kind of like heavy metal ballad to Satan kind of thing. And apparently it was co-written by John Carpenter, who has a cameo as their producer.
Oh, fun.
So like that bit sounds cool, but like that feels like a really big missed opportunity is to put some songs in this thing and get like a good album out of it too.
Yeah.
Like, why not? I would love to see a Foo Fighters Halloween concept album. Like, ooh, what are we going to put on for a Halloween party? Let's put on, like, you know, Trick or Foo or whatever. Foo or Treat. I don't know. Like, one of those. Let's do that. Why didn't we do that? It feels like a big missed opportunity. It's kind
of
weird.
To bring it up again, that's House of a Thousand Corpses.
Yeah.
Rob Zombie put out a record
to
go with it.
Yeah.
Just with a lot of original songs. He does a cover of Brick House on that one.
Sure. Like, I feel like, did you ever see the Super Bowl episode of The Simpsons?
Where they go to a couple of those,
Well, there's one where they go to the Super Bowl, and it's, they clearly filmed it, like, because animation, they do it, like, years in advance, so they didn't know who's playing at the Super Bowl, and they have to, like, hide everyone's mouths while they say it, like, says, oh, yeah, oh, I can't wait to see the Super Bowl, I can't wait to see the, Homer puts, like, a book over his face, Atlanta Falcons.
Oh, that's right, yeah, I saw that one. The Falcons and the Broncos were playing that.
Yeah, and so they go to the Super Bowl, and they never get to the Super Bowl. They're always, like, trying to get in. And also they meet Dolly Parton, who helps them, like, break out of, like, Super Bowl jail. But at the end,
I run Dollywood and Euro Dollywood. That one's in Tennessee.
It's a good line. But, like, the end of it, there's, like, a little fourth wall commentary where it was just like, wait a minute, did we just do a Super Bowl episode where we never saw any football and there was Dolly Parton and there was no halftime show or singing? What the fuck was that? What kind of crap was that? And I kind of feel like that a little bit with Studio 666. We got the humor. We got to hang out with the Foo Fighters. We got some fun, gory bits and homages to Evil Dead and shit. All that stuff is great. Kind of missed the music. Kind of a big draw. It's kind of weird. But I had a good time. And I think it's fun. It just doesn't need to be that long. That's the biggest tragedy.
Yeah.
Tell me about something else. Tell me about Hellbender. We're on a horror kick.
All right. Hellbender is a new film that was just released on Shudder this week, and it is the result of an enclave that is a filmmaking family. They're called the Addams Family, but with one D.
Oh, okay. Well, then that's fine.
Their names are actually Addams, however. So, okay. So Zelda Addams plays a teenage girl. Toby Poser plays her real mom, plays her mom. And they live on a mountain together, and the main character, the teenage girl, her name is Izzy, has some strangely defined illness, and she's not allowed to interact with other people. This is after a prologue that takes place in sort of the Salem witch trials. The film opens with a witch being hung and not dying, and they shoot it through the head multiple times, and it still doesn't die. And,
God.
It's clearly like this monstrous thing, and it's like moving around, and then it just explodes and flies into the air while it's on fire.
Awesome. Does it look cool?
It's pretty awesome. And in fact, there are a few moments where characters put their hand on like a cursed book, and they get that sort of flashback thing where they get little bits of information.
Uh-huh.
It is flickering insanity.
Ooh.
These moments where we get sort of that flashback information that it's actually really exciting to look at.
That's awesome.
There's so many boring ways to do that, and I've seen them all. And this one, they actually do it in an exciting way.
That's cool, man.
But back to the story, this Izzy girl ends up wandering out into the woods. And while she's out on her own, her mom meets a hiker. And the mom magically turns the hiker into ash. Just poof. Just makes him melt. So something fishy's going on here.
No, that's perfectly normal. What are you talking about? That's nothing weird.
Izzy, meanwhile, makes friends with another teenager, like local teenagers who are sort of squatting in a nearby house. She doesn't know how to talk to people. She hasn't had any social interaction. She's meant to sort of stay away. Her entire life is just making like punk ballads with her mom in their garage. For the band that they have together, she and her mom, and then the band is called Hellbender. While she's hanging out with these teenagers, they play some fun teenage games, one of which involves eating a live worm. She eats a live worm, and she goes berserk. And she starts seeing weird colors and feeling this weird murderous urge and goes after some of these teenagers. And she staggers back to her mom and says, "What's going on?" And she says, "Well, you know what? Honey, we're witches. Teen witch.
Okay.
You're a teen witch." And a lot of the movie is then devoted to redefining their relationship with this new information, and the mom explaining a lot about how witchdom works. It's incredibly warm and interesting, and like psychologically real and emotionally real, the way a mom is now relating to her growing daughter.
Okay. Because
they have to kind of redefine their relationship a little, and that's kind of what you have to do as a parent as well.
Like, it sounds like a tonal shift based on how you're describing it.
A little bit of, because it's all of a sudden it becomes this little bit more of this genial thing where it becomes about parenthood and learning how to relate to your child as they get older and come upon new realizations about themselves. So she explains, we're witches, we can eat life. Like, let's eat an ant and see what happens. And then you eat an ant and you can, like, smell blood in the air. And then she teaches her little spells about, like, rubbing moss or picking toadstools in a very frank, matter-of-fact sort of way.
But
also still in a very, like, visually interesting sort of way. She teaches her that if you eat a maggot, because maggots are so closely associated with death, it's essentially like getting super high.
Oh, wow.
And there's some really, like, warm but weirdly disturbing scenes where they eat maggots and they're getting high together. They're, like, vomiting blood onto each other, but it's seen in this very kind of, like, bonding experience.
Yeah.
And, of course, the reason why the teenage daughter has been kept away from everything is because when you're a witch and you can eat life and gain power, you tend to become a mad cannibal monster after a while.
Well, so I mean, that's one option.
So there's echoes of the movie Raw in that. Because in the movie Raw, at the beginning, that's about a young woman who goes to veterinary school. And when she eats, I think it's a rabbit's kidney.
Well, she'd never eaten meat before. She was a vegetarian family.
Her mom, like, kept her away from eating meat. And during her...
As soon as she starts eating meat, she becomes obsessed with it. And
biting into flesh and eating meat. And, you know, before you know it, she's eating people. Raw is a really terrific movie.
Raw is amazing. Yeah. Raw is from the director of Titan. See them both. Amazing.
It's a Julie Ducournau film.
Can't wait to see what they do next. Holy shit.
The story sort of resembles Raw. And we start to teeter with Izzy, the teenage girl, whether or not she's going to become a monster and start eating people after a while, or if her mom will be able to sort of relate to her. I love the dynamic, because they're actually mother and daughter.
Yeah, it sounds really good.
The warmth and the relation they have is on screen. It's right up there. And the father of this family unit is co-writer and co-director as well. So he was also on set. The whole family was on set together. And making this horror movie about eating life and being witches.
You see a lot of people who, like, collaborate with, like, family, like a brother or a sister or a spouse, perhaps, or a child. Whole family. It's interesting. Yeah, you don't see that very often.
I've seen movies like where mothers and daughters are both actors and they'll have scenes opposite each other. But like Wild at Heart, for instance.
Get everyone involved in the project. Like, we're all working at Bob's Burgers or something. That's interesting.
I know you just don't see that.
You just don't
like
see that
like Kevin Smith. We were talking about this. He did yoga hosers with his daughter, and he's in it, but he plays like this little miniature sausage monster.
Yeah, mostly he was just on set as a director.
This is like a whole family making this horror movie together.
It's really interesting.
So I found all that really, really interesting. The ending sucks.
No!
It just turns into this really pat, predictable ending, and it feels like they ran out of money. It's like, because all of a sudden there's this sequence where they go into sort of this dark space, and a lot of this action takes place where there's no set. It looks like they had to finish the film in their garage and sort of like rush it out and just do something to wrap everything up. I feel like there was a lot more fascinating things going on throughout the movie that warranted a much more interesting, just sort of cliched horror movie ending that we got.
Yeah.
It practically undoes everything that we had up to that point. Sort of how abrupt and
I hate that.
And uninteresting the ending is.
Oh, you gotta stick the landing. That sucks.
It really, really completely stumbles at the end. But up until that point, I was really invested.
Okay.
So a film can be undone by a bad ending. It's not completely undone, but they really should have thought of something more fascinating to do than just sort of like a typical horror movie ending. It feels really, really typical.
All right. Well, let's do a huge, huge shift in tone and talk about a new family film, a dramedy about family from director Stephanie Lang.
Okay.
I hope I'm pronouncing that right. L-A-I-N-G. It is a film called Family Squares. Mm-hmm. And Family Squares refers to Zoom calls during the pandemic. And this takes place during the pandemic. It addresses the pandemic directly as a plot point. I'm grateful that we're starting to see movies that acknowledge what happened. Mm-hmm. Because some places are just like, yeah, just we're all kind of hazily aware of what happened between like 2019, 2020, or whatever. Like, eh. Like, no, this is right in the middle of the pandemic. And like a lot of, sadly, a lot of people, this is a story about when a family has to mourn the passing of a loved one, but because of the quarantine, because of the pandemic, they can't see each other and they can't have a proper funeral. And that's really sad.
Yeah.
A lot of people have done that. And I'm sorry if that happened to you. It's not fair. But it was certainly an unusual situation. It's a distinct situation. And making a movie about that, interesting idea. Especially considering that they had to make this movie remotely. And for the majority of the film, the characters are not on screen together. They're talking over video phone. They're talking over Zoom. It wasn't recorded over Zoom, but they were talking over Zoom in the film. The mom who dies at the beginning of the film is played by June Squibb, who is always great. And I actually really like her in this movie. She's basically, the movie opens with her talking to her great-granddaughter, played by Elsie Fisher from Texas Chainsaw. Saying, it's my time. Get the family on the phone. Everyone gets on the phone, and they're all saying goodbye and everything like that, and June Squibb passes away, and it's very, very sad. And then there's the reading of the will a few days later, and June Squibb has left a video message, and the video message is basically like, hey, everyone, don't mind me, I'm dead. Anyway, I just thought you should know that there's a secret treasure. One of you is adopted, and I'm not going to tell you which one. One of you has been embezzling from the family. And that's great. Then June Squibb was like, okay, that's it. I might have another video later.
Is this a Benoit Blanc movie?
I know, right? And then at the end, she's just like, oh, and anyway, I got to go. I got to get back to being dead. Bye. Classic. Classic June Squibb. Great bit. And I got to say, the cast they got for this movie... a little hit and miss, but pretty good. You can listen to Elsie Fisher, who is just a really talented young actor, and I really can't. I'm really glad we're seeing more of her. We got Judy Greer, we got Billy Magnuson, we got Ann Dowd and Margot Martindale
in the room together for the first time.
That's like being in a movie with the Dylan McDermott and Dermot Mulroney. Like, whoa, like holy shit! I think this is literally first.
I like them both.
Yeah.
I
don't think they've ever been in a movie together, and they definitely, I don't think they've ever had like a scene together. So when they finally have a scene that's just the two of them, it's unfortunate that it's over video phone, but it's kind of like the scene where Al Pacino and Robert De Niro finally have a scene together in Heat. Like, and it's a pretty good scene. They're good together.
Martindale.
Ann Dowd plays the woman that June Squibb married late in life. I guess she realized she came out of the closet late in life. Mm-hmm. And Margot Martindale plays her daughter.
Okay.
Henry Winkler plays her son. You know, pretty Sam Richardson shows up from Werewolves Within. He plays what's the guy? The guy who works at the funeral parlor.
The mortician?
The mortician. No, not just the mortician. He's planning the funeral, and he's also
the funeral director.
And also, to save money on hiring another guy as a lawyer, he also got, like, he's also a lawyer, and he can handle the will, because, why bother hiring another actor when you can get Sam Richardson? The good is that this is a sweet idea. The good is that there are some very genuinely good emotional moments here, and the cast is mostly quite game. The bad is that this movie is weird. There's like this whole bit like
weird is usually welcome.
I'm trying to. Give me a second. Right. So there's repeatedly throughout the movie for like scene transitions, there are CGI roosters with targets on them.
Okay.
This is never properly explained, but is kind of alluded to in the last scene, but not in a way that makes you go, oh, I get it. It's just like, what were we doing here? There is a voiceover narration by Rob Reiner.
Okay.
And Rob Reiner, A, he's recorded on the worst microphone they had. B, his voiceover is terrible. It's really, really... that doesn't contribute anything.
How does it compare to Eric Roberts in A Talking Cat?
Actually, it's about the same in terms of voice quality. God. Like, he's giving more of a performance than Eric Roberts, but the audio quality is about the same, which is a real bummer, and it really brings the production value down. And his commentary is mostly useless. I think he's mostly there to smooth over one plot point that never quite gets resolved unless he mentions it. Because otherwise he adds nothing. And his like running joke commentary when he tries to make things funny is embarrassing. There's like a whole bit where like the whole family is like angry at each other and squabbling, and they all hang up on Zoom. And then you hear Rob Reiner go, "Well, looks like we need a recount in South Carolina."
Oh my God.
Too soon, Rob. Too fucking soon, Rob. What the hell? Barely a joke in the first place. Doesn't even really apply to anything. So that part stinks. Mm-hmm. And also the other trick is when you're making a movie with so many, basically, there's a few additional shots where, like, you know, the actors, like, set up a camera and film, like, a scene, like, off to the side. But about 85% of it is close-ups on Zoom. Mm. Very unforgiving to continuity. Very unforgiving. Now, I'm normally not the kind of person who will be super distracted if there are little continuity errors. Like, oh, that glass was on that side of the table and not this side. I usually don't notice. I usually don't care. So when I notice and I care, it's bad. There's, like, a bit in this movie where, like, we cut to June Squibb doing her, like, reading of the will video. Mm-hmm. And she's talking to everybody. Then we cut to, from a medium of her to a close-up of her in the middle of the same conversation. Suddenly she's just wearing glasses. Like, it's just really...
Oh, gosh.
They just really didn't get what they needed there. And it's, and I realize that's probably the result of a very tricky production in which you're directing remotely and filming remotely and asking all the actors to do their own bits remotely. But it's the peril, and that's the downfall of it at times. There's also a couple of characters who feel like they're in different movies. Like, okay, so this person might be adopted. This person's kind of the you know, black sheep of the family, and this person never quite got used to having, like, a second mom, and all this kind of stuff feels really, really real. And then there's, like, Scott MacArthur, who just wrote a book about the time he was impaled with a javelin. And then there's, like, Billy Magnuson, who is, like, Skyping in from Russia because he's a famous hacker. And I'm like, these are different films. What are we doing here?
Wait a minute. William, what are you talking about?
Exactly. Like, these are different movies. Yeah. Like, it's just, there's just these weird bits where it feels like every time the movie loses confidence and tries to, like, get our attention by being funny or being weird or having an outlandish plot point, it saps away what really matters here, which is there was a time period where this was the way in which we communicated with people in our lives, almost exclusively for a lot of us. Mm-hmm. And to have to go through a harrowing emotional experience this way was something that a lot of us are going to remember. Every time you make that less genuine, you harm this movie. When it's genuine, the movie pretty much works. Mm-hmm. It's a little lo-fi, but it works. When it's not genuine, it brings it all way the fuck down. Yeah. So it's a big old mixed bag, and it's a shame because I think there's a really good heart here. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it quite works. All right, and then we got one more. Tell me about A Banquet.
Well, good golly. This is going to be a downshift.
Oh, dear.
Because this is a very intense movie.
Okay.
A Banquet begins with Sienna Guillory. Plays a woman whose husband is dying of a terminal disease.
Okay.
And the movie opens with him taking his own life.
Oh, God.
And she and her teenage daughter witness this. She has two teenage daughters. One was out of the house, a little, slightly younger than her older teenage daughter is named Betsy.
Right.
She's played by an actress named Jessica Alexander.
Okay.
And shortly after this happens, Betsy begins losing her appetite. She just stops eating. She develops this severe aversion to food.
Okay.
She goes to a party and, like, sees, like, something in the sky. And after that, she just doesn't have any kind of draw to eat. And there's a lot of sort of torturous scenes where her mother has noticed that she's not eating anymore. And there's a really intense scene where she tries to get her to eat just, like, a single pea. And she, like, can barely stand to do it. And she's really distressed by this. And days begin to pass, and she still hasn't eaten. And then months begin to pass, and she still hasn't eaten. And she's also not losing any weight.
Oh.
She's just not eating.
Well, that's a proper mystery,
She has no desire to eat. She's In fact, her mom begins to weigh her day after day after day, and her weight is just not changing at all. She's not wasting away. She's not suffering any sort of effects of being malnourished. She's just simply not eating. But in so doing, it starts to unlock a lot of strange emotional and spiritual journeys for all of the family. The younger sister, in seeing her sister fasting, begins saying things like, she's teaching me a lot. She's teaching me what it's like to be nothing.
Okay.
I'm not sure if you're familiar with sort of the historical and religious significance of fasting, but many religious disciplines involve fasting as sort of a spiritually cleansing exercise.
Yeah.
We're actually coming up on Ash Wednesday, which is the beginning of Lent on the Christian calendar,
right,
which is a period of fasting. That's 47 days where, you know, the modern version of it is you just give up something.
Is it 47? I thought it was 40.
It's 40. You're supposed to get Sundays off. It's 40. Ah. It's 40, actually 47 days.
Ah, okay.
Just where the fasting is only for 40 days.
Okay, got it.
So yeah, if you're giving up something pretty extreme, you'll at least get a day off.
Well, that's nice.
And Betsy begins to feel as if she's been touched by some sort of divine presence. It's almost like an angelic possession story. It's like demonic possession, but she feels like she's possessed by an angel. But it has that sort of sense of dread around it. It's not this beatific Christian movie, even though it's almost explicitly about Christian themes.
Yeah.
It feels like a horror movie because everybody's feeling like fearful and afraid. We don't really know what the cause of this mystery is. People are discovering new exhilaration in nihilistic viewpoints. This can only come to some sort of tragic conclusion. It doesn't seem like there's going to be back to normal for this family.
Yeah. It sounds harrowing.
It's harrowing, and I really loved it. I loved the intensity. It deals with subject matter that we don't see talked about in movie, and that's sort of like the psychological and spiritual connection people have to food and eating, and specifically not eating. Yeah. When you talk about food movies, we usually talk about indulgence, isn't it? It's about the senses. Denying sensual pleasure is not something that is typically seen as having any kind of positive angle in movies. Usually when you see people fasting or like being denied a sensual pleasure, they're usually depicted as sort of like a repressed sort of figure.
Yeah.
In this one, this denial of food is seen as almost a path to enlightenment in a weird way. But at the same time, it's not depicted as something that's being not very healthy. And it's actually having adverse effects on everyone that's coming into contact with her. She's just not eating. That's all that's going on.
Yeah.
She sits at the table and her plate is empty. But everyone is completely undone by her inaction when it comes to food.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it ends in the... I don't want to say anything about how it ends there. But, it ends in on a sort of a spiritual note. There's a lot to unlock. There's a lot to deal with in this one. I think if you're familiar with a lot of sort of the practice of fasting and sort of the way we have approached fasting as a practice throughout society, you're going to get a lot out of this movie. I think I have a book by Ricky Jay.
Oh, yeah. Learned Beasts.
But not Learned Beasts. It's Jay's Journal of Anomalies. Ricky Jay wrote several books about strange entertainments. Pigs who can count. People who can extract whatever you ask for out of their pockets. Somebody who can get inside a ball and roll up a ramp. That kind of thing. And he collected playbills, advertising these things. And he actually has a whole bit in Jay's Journal about fasting as a form of entertainment. People who would say, I'm going to get in this room and for 1 week I'm not going to eat. And people would come from miles around to watch them not eat.
Just to be sure.
I guess. And of course,
they better not do it.
Most of them were scams.
Well,
of course they were. And he stayed in this house on the top of a pole. Oh, wait a minute. There's a tube up the pole. It's like a little pulley system. It was just giving him snacks all the time. It's like, this guy was not fasting. As somebody who's had a little bit of a fraught relationship with food all throughout his life, this film kind of spoke to me.
Okay.
So it kind of was important to me in a personal sort of way.
Sure.
But more than that, I think it does speak to the way we tend to view food and the way we tend to think about food and how we kind of take food for granted, especially in the developed world, where we have maybe far too much of it a lot of the time.
There's no, the scarcity doesn't hit as many people here
like,
as elsewhere.
There are food deserts and hungry people in the United States.
Oh, yes, there are.
I'm not at all implying that there aren't.
No. But it's... there's a lot of people who don't live in fear of not knowing what they're going to eat today.
Yeah.
You know, like there aren't, and that they will encounter these stories differently.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is a movie that is trying to come at that from the opposite angle. Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen that before.
That's interesting.
In a feature film. So yeah, I'm going to be thinking about A Banquet for a long time.
That's exciting. Okay. Well, let's review some movies on the critically acclaimed scale. This, once again, we do a lot of talking about various films and sometimes we've been told it's difficult to say where we land. So we review films on the critically acclaimed scale. This is a scale of C minus to C plus. A C, that's average. Hmm. Some good, some bad. Some people will like it more than others if it's a particular genre or whatever. C plus is above average. That's a movie we genuinely recommend. That could be just genuinely quite good to the greatest movie ever made. Boom, they're all covered under C plus. And then C minus, that is below average. That is either we just don't find a particular reason to recommend this, or it's absolutely fucking awful. Anywhere in the middle of those two extremes, boom, C minus. Wendy, on that note, where does A Banquet fall?
It's a C plus for me.
Cool.
I really dug it. It's complex and terribly, terribly interesting.
Nice. Family Squares. Mm. There's stuff I like about it, and it's hard to be mad at a film that has, again, Margot Martindale and Ann Dowd in a scene together, and if that was all there was to it, it would be great. But unfortunately, I think the movie is really undermined by the its lack of confidence in the drama, because the humor mostly falls flat, and also some technical issues. So I'm going to give it a very high C-.
All right.
It's not a tragedy, but I don't think it quite works, and it's a bit of a bummer. Let's see. Moving on, the Hellbender.
A C. The ending prevents it from being great.
Yeah.
Which is really unfortunate because it just sort of slams into something really schlocky by the end. But up until then, I thought it was really fascinating.
Okay. Studio 666, a C as well. A high C. I think there are definitely people who are going to enjoy this more than others. If you like the Foo Fighters, definitely hang out with the Foo Fighters. If you like horror movies and the Foo Fighters, you're probably going to love this. But I think it overstays its welcome. I think it just runs out of energy by the end. And ultimately, that's a crime that comes with a penalty. So here's your C. And then The Cursed.
Oh, The Cursed is a high C.
Okay.
I liked all of the atmosphere. I liked all of the werewolf stuff. Could have hit a little bit harder, I think. Maybe done something a little bit striking or clever with the story. But as just sort of like a straightforward monster movie, it's a pretty good one.
All right, Dog.
It can only be a C.
Okay.
It's way too laid back to feel passionate about this movie. But yeah, it's a C.
All right.
Pleasant. It's just pleasant.
All right. No Exit.
No Exit, C minus. You don't have to see this.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you can skip it.
That's a little harsh, I think. I think it's a high C.
All right.
I think this is a perfectly functional, decent... This is a decent thriller. I think this is decently crafted. I enjoyed watching it for the most part. It's just... it never quite hits that extra note and becomes great. Mm. But I think if you enjoy thrillers, this is a perfectly enjoyable thriller, but it never hits... It for me, this is the definition of a C.
Right.
For me, this is just like, there's nothing wrong with it. It just never does anything great.
Well, I think it's decent, but I don't think it's anything more than decent, which is not something I would say to somebody that I'd recommend a film to.
Yeah. Well, again, I wouldn't go out of my way to say you must see No Exit.
Right.
But if they're just like, oh, I'm going to watch No Exit tonight, will I have a good time? I'm like, yeah, probably.
Probably.
So for me, that's a C. I guess maybe we approach it a little differently. And then lastly, the new Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Also C minus. Kind of sucks. I like the gore. There's some interesting concepts. I think our conversation was more interesting than the movie.
Yeah, probably.
This whole Texas Chainsaw thing is pretty insubstantial as is. As a slasher goes, sure, fine, fun gore.
Yeah.
But you're not, you will not be missing anything out of your life by missing this movie.
You're definitely not missing anything out of your life. However, I do think that as maybe alongside Texas Chainsaw 3D, the only film in this franchise that acknowledges that we're just a slasher. We're not more profound than that. We don't have something to say about family or whatever. This is basically just monster attacks people. People die. It's unfortunate that it whiffs all of like the big themes that it brings up, but as a purely functional slasher, I think it works. I actually think that you're gonna have like a oh shit, like, you know, like a good, this is a good film to watch at a party where everyone's gonna like sort of scream and squeal and like close their eyes, like, you know, the really gory bits or whatever like that. I think as a pure unadulterated slasher, this is a high C. But as like anything deeper than that, obviously I would agree with you. But I think for the people who are looking for a slasher, a genre which is not moribund but not doing great, this will scratch that itch.
It's we can let the slasher go.
I don't mind it. If you like the genre, some genres wane, and it's hard to find a good one. And so when one comes around, which scratches the itch, I think it's okay to say, hey. Remember when there were a bunch of slashers? This is actually pretty good for one. There you go. Boom. It whiffs some important stuff, but it gets the gore right, and that's kind of all it's really trying to do. So I'm going to let it have a little slack. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that is it for Critically Acclaimed this week. We'll be back next week with a review of The Batman.
That's right. There's a new Batman.
I guess the other ones are just a Batman now. But we'll do The Batman. There's also a new horror movie coming out called Fresh, which I saw, not at Sundance, because no one went to Sundance, but I saw a screener link from Sundance. Okay. And I'm very fond of it, so I can't wait to talk about it with Whitney. And some other stuff as well is coming out. I think there's a new film from the director of Columbus called After Yang.
Oh, I like Columbus.
Yeah, yeah. I'll try to check that out. But the Batman's sucking up all the oxygen in the room, so not a lot of things are opening opposite it. So we'll see what happens. Anyway, that is it for Critically Acclaimed. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Special thank you to all of our patrons, without whom our show would not exist. If you want to join the conversation, there's several ways to do that. The best way is to email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read your email in an upcoming episode of our show. We've got mail, so feel free to ask us questions, take us to task if we, you know, said something you disagree with, because art is subjective and we're interested in your opinions. We're also on Twitter @CriticAcclaim. I'm @WilliamDeBiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
Whitney, I forgot. What is our PO box?
Oh yeah, send us an actual physical letter. Critically Acclaimed Network, PO Box 641565, Los Angeles, California 90064.
And I guess that's about it. So, once again, thanks everybody for listening, and thank you for your patience last week. We're going to be picking up the pace, and we got a lot of good stuff coming for you this week here at Critically Acclaimed. And never forget, everyone is a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?